Your book attempts to trace the idea of the promised land from biblical times through medieval European Christianity, early capitalism, right through to present-day corporate globalization. It's a very ambitious task. Can you tell us how you came to write the book?
Yes. I got the inspiration for it as a participant in the anti-globalization movement, working with people roughly half my age. And I remember several meetings in the mobilization for global justice. We were planning the Quebec City demonstrations. And it just struck me that there was no resonance in the discussions of any kind of what we could call transcendental guarantees. No one was talking about God on our side, history on our side, the advance of industry or technology, or much less, of course, the market being some kind of panacea. And this struck me as something new. I'd been involved in political activity and political movements for 30 years, and all of them had been, if not suffused, at least influenced by these kinds of notions. So it struck me that the anti-globalization movement was different, was something new, and I came to believe eventually that it was essentially the living negation of the core mythology of our culture. And I wrote the book to really hold a mirror up to the movement so that it could see its significance in a much broader, from a much broader perspective. I mean, as you probably know, and your listeners certainly know, there have been many efforts to try to understand this movement and try to sort of pin down its vision, etc. And all of this has been, to my mind, much too short. That is looking for some kind of immediate meaning, when actually the meaning is much larger and much more grand. So that's what prompted me to write the book. And well, I wrote it for the movement, and the book is written in the style and the form without any academic apparatus, and it's in a form, paperback, small book, so that people, activists, can read it.
Well, let's get into the argument that you make. We could just start with this idea of the promised land,
right.
And maybe you can start by just telling us, what does that mean in the Bible itself?
Well, before we look at it in the Bible, let's just look at it, you know, in a very common sense understanding. I mean, if we look at the idea and the structure of a promise, okay? Kristen, I promise you fame and fortune, let's say. Okay, that's me giving you a promise, okay? Immediately, it shifts our focus of attention from the today, from the moment, from the here and now, from the present, to some future fulfillment of the promise. That's one of the implications of a promise. Secondly, it shifts the source of your destiny, that is, from you shaping your own life, to some kind of faith that I will, as the keeper of the promise. That is, you are not going to achieve fame and fortune by your own designs, but it will come to you as a result of the fulfillment of the promise that I made to you. Okay, so the implications of a promise is, first of all, a kind of deferment of life, a shift from experience to expectation, so to speak, from now to the future. Okay, and secondly, it entails a kind of alienation from your own agency, and instead a kind of determinism, some kind of guarantor of the fulfillment of the promise. Now, this is all the more pronounced when the promise is made not by me, a human being, but allegedly by some supposed supernatural being. Okay. So the estrangement from our own shaping of our own destiny and the determinism, the power of some kind of other agency in our life is magnified exponentially. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a promise that was made. Again, this is mythology. These are fairy tales we're talking about here, just so everyone understands it. The story is that there was a person named Abraham who never existed, who one day hears voices, and the voices are from some supernatural, disembodied, invisible entity. And these voices make a promise, actually a series of promises. This is from Genesis in the Bible. Chapter 12 is when it begins. A promise of future greatness, a promise of future greatness to the heirs of Abraham, a promise of some vaguely defined piece of real estate. And the quid pro quo, what Abraham has to do is heed this this voice, obey the commands of this voice, and then the promise will be fulfilled. That's the story. And this promise, which begins in the Old Testament, is then carried forward into the New Testament with the second fairy tale about a person named Jesus Christ, who also never existed, in which the Messiah, some person who has a strange relationship, a very almost an identical relationship with this supernatural entity, comes to life and then is killed and then is resurrected. And this is the embodiment, that resurrection, of the promise of the fulfillment that was offered to Abraham. That is, the fulfillment being the restoration of perfection. I mean, the foundation of this whole story is the story of Adam and Eve and the expulsion from the Garden of Eden and the loss of perfection and divine likeness. And what God is promising to Abraham in from chapter 12 on is a restoration of that perfection. In fact, it's explicit: go thou before me and be perfect. So Christ in the story of Christianity is a elaboration, and in a way an intensification of this mythology.
What's most striking to me in the book is how you sort of trace that idea through medieval Europe and into the modern times, and you look at how the idea of a restoration of perfection and sort of finding the divine design as a way to sort of come back to that perfect state, how that was key to medieval scientists and then to the early economists, people we would call economists now. And you quote from many of these figures who are, you know, well known to people in the academic world and are sort of are part of our popular culture too in a certain way. And you quote them talking about their religious inspiration. Can you give us some examples from your research, from your argument about how that idea of the promised land has gone through different permutations?
Well, again, let me emphasize that this book is written primarily about and for the present, for today. And the reason I'm interested in this this mythology and the beliefs is because it's still at the center of our self-understanding today. So that this isn't simply a history book. The reason I'm going through a succession of examples is really to bring us back to the present, so that today the idea of globalization, the idea of some kind of salvation through technology, the idea of some invisible hand of the market being the guarantor of freedom and harmony in the world, and of course the wealth of nations, the idea that history, the very idea of history, all derives from this mythology. That is, that there is some kind of plan that has an order and a direction and a telos, a goal, which is the restoration of perfection, is in our cortex. Everyone. When students walk into a class, I ask them, how many people here believe in God? Almost all of them acknowledge that they do. And then I ask them, how many believe in two gods? How many believe in seven gods? Okay. They all believe in one God. They're all monotheists. They don't know why. I ask them, how many people here know the story of Adam and Eve? Never have I encountered a student who didn't know that story, because it's constitutive of our culture. So, to get back to your question, I mean, all of the examples, looking at, again, going backwards, I'm tracing the idea of, first, the religious idea. So I talk quite a lot about the Bible itself, in particular Genesis and the first books of the New Testament, the Book of Revelation especially, and then the history of millenarianism. And in particular, I'm focusing on people like Joachim of Fiore, who really devised this probably the most powerful system or prophetic system of the West up until perhaps Karl Marx. And people like Vico, some of the foremost theorists of the idea of history, people like Kant, Condorcet. The construction, again, this is just an idea. There's no such thing as history. There's no such thing as the future and the past. These are all imaginative constructs. There is only today, me, Dave, talking to you, Kristen. That's all that exists, okay? Everything else we have to imagine and we construct in our imaginations. And the idea of the market, I trace that from not only Adam Smith, but some of his contemporaries, the idea of essentially shifting from a household-based economy, which is the Greek word for the definition of the word economy, to a divine-based economy, which in the 17th and 18th centuries went by the name of the divine economy, the divine economy, the divine economy of salvation. And so rather than a shift away from religion, it was actually a shift towards religion. What the market is a obviously derivative religious construction. That is, that human beings are not really capable of managing their affairs for all sorts of reasons, being imperfect beings, having fallen from grace. And so the market is grounded upon divine perfection and reliable, predictable order, which is only realizable in a divine setting. That's what the market is all about. And again, our belief in history, our belief in the market, could not exist without our prior belief in the existence of a God, which is determining the plan. Okay. So all of these ideas, and then science and technology, I mean, I talk about the great, you know, Boyle, Newton, all the great scientists were profoundly influenced. I mean, they were out-and-out millenarians. And I argue in another book, Religion of Technology, all of our contemporary hallmark technologies, genetic engineering, space exploration, artificial intelligence, are all religious projects. To me, it's obvious. Globalization is just another word, a one-word substitute for the two-word free trade, which emerges in the 19th century, and I talk a lot about the history of that mythology with the debate over the corn laws in England, where one of the proponents, these are masters factory owners from Manchester, actually says in their propaganda that free trade is Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is free trade. Just so no one forgets that this is a religious idea, and since people believe in these religious ideas, they would believe in the derivative ideas as well, such as deliverance through technology, deliverance through the market, salvation in globalization, etc. These are all religious ideas. That's why they work, because they really push to the ground of our being, the core of our culture. Okay, the pre-reflective essence of our imagination, of the Western imagination. That's what it's all about. Okay, but what I'm arguing in the book is that this mythology is essentially estranging us from the here and now, which is really all that exists, and therefore from any action on our own behalf, which can only take place in the here and now because that's all that exists. And this whole mythology is, I would say, designed to defer action infinitely, okay, and await the second coming, await the fulfillment of the promise. And the anti-globalization movement has rejected this utterly. Ya basta, enough, no more waiting. Today, now, here, this place.
We're speaking with David Noble, author of Beyond the Promised Land, The Movement and the Myth. Before we talk a little bit more about the anti-globalization movement, I want to discuss a little bit how the idea of the promised land has become part also of social movements, which see that in a liberatory way. And you know, of course, Martin Luther King Jr. is one of the most, you know, obvious examples of somebody who refers to that concept. And you also talk about Marxism and how it's also kind of part of, or how it draws from that same inspiration. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. That is, if you have a derivative idea of history as salvation, and this goes back to millenarian constructions. I mentioned Joachim of Fiore wouldn't be familiar to most of your listeners. He's living in the 11th and 12th centuries. But this is a man who essentially formulated the idea of three stages of history, and culminating, of course, in the millennium, which is a word that only appears in the book of Revelation, referring to the thousand-year period after the return of the Messiah. And millenarianism is the belief in the inevitability of the coming millennium. So all the great scientists, like I just mentioned, spent a lot of their time, Newton especially, trying to figure out when the millennium would come. They all assumed it would. And this belief, this assurance, this guarantee, came to suffuse movements of resistance. And especially in Europe, millenarian movements of the disenfranchised, peasant rebellions, etc., they were all motivated and inspired by mythologies, millenarian mythologies, various people identifying themselves as the returned Messiah. And that gave people a certain kind of confidence that, as we say, history was on their side, that their efforts will be successful because it is ordained, it is preordained, it is inevitable, it is part of God's plan, okay? And modern movements, such as, the socialist movement, it was just a variation of millenarianism, the emphasis upon studying history so that we will know its direction and therefore try to reconcile our actions with the known, determined course of history, as identified by the great thinkers, Kant or Marx or whoever, gives confidence to those who are participating, saying, you know, this is inevitable. We are on the side of history, of course, meaning the side of God. And therefore, we will triumph, and even if we fail today, and even if we apparently are losing, we know that we will prevail. Okay, and this goes back to the ancient Hebrews who are being destroyed by the Romans, and they start getting supernatural. The book of Daniel, for example, and it comes to a peak in the story of Christ as well. That the persecuted, the oppressed, will in fact prevail because it is ordained. Okay, and again, it gave a sense of confidence, a sense of assurance, a sense of hope to people. The civil rights movement also was infused with this hope. The anti-globalization movement has none of it. Of course, there are so-called faith-based participants who very rarely examine their faith, which is as I'm saying, the basis of all the ideas that they're railing against. I mean, faith-based resistance to the idea of globalization or the market, to me, is kind of absurd, because the market and the globalization are essentially derivative of the same faith-based orientation. So a little reflection is required there. But anyway, faith-based participants in the anti-globalization movement, they're there, but they don't define the movement. Various socialist sectarians and what have you are very, very much present and very helpful and influential, but they don't define the movement either. Okay. If anything defines the movement, and in a way it's an oxymoron, I mean to say that anarchism defines the movement, but there is no, as Herbert Marcuse put it, transcendental guarantees operating here. And that's why this movement is something new, in the history of movements in the West, because it has departed from the fundamental mythology. It does not gain confidence or hope from such mythology, but rather from life itself, from existence in the present, from affinity that people have with one another. That's what it's about. Okay. And when I say the here and now, I'm not being nihilistic at all. I'm being realistic, because what we're talking about here is essentially a return from exile, exile from the present, from really the reality of our lives, into some kind of fictive, imaginative realm that ultimately absolves us of responsibility for our own lives.
Well, that's a great way, I think, to wrap up this conversation. Before we go, do you have any thoughts you'd like to share with people as we're in this holiday season?
Yes, well, just one. I mean, one thing has always been a puzzle to me, that children seem to outgrow belief in Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny, but somehow they don't outgrow the belief in Jesus Christ, Abraham, the Messiah. And it's a puzzle. They're all fairy tales.
Thank you very much, David Noble, for joining us on CKLN.
My pleasure.